day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays, but you can tune in 24/7 and hear us anytime you please through our radio archive on our website, redicecreations.com. We also have frequently updated news with articles, links to news and research that we consider to be of interest from around this planet and beyond. Our free radio archive extends back a year, but we have a member section on our website, and as a member you'll get full access to our archive that goes back to over 2 years, and also all the extended interviews that we do with many of our guests. This is an excellent resource if you want to dive deeper into many of the subjects that we discuss on this program. We also have articles, members forum, film and video material available for you there as well. You can find much more information about this on our website, redicecreations.com. And for this Sunday's program, we have a new guest with us, a researcher, author and lecturer that we've wanted to get on the program for a long time. We finally have David Flynn with us. He has done some fantastic research and lectures that I hope you are familiar with. If not, we hope to introduce you today to some of his work and give you a taste of some of the new material that he has been researching lately. David Flynn is doing really groundbreaking research on everything from ancient mysteries and origins of megalithic sites to illuminated fraternities, geometry, and with the connection to prophecy, scripture, 2012, and so much more. He's also the author of Sidonia, The Secret Chronicles of Mars. We'll talk more about David's books and lecture DVDs later in the program. I also want to mention that David is behind the Watcher website. The URL to this will is basically mt.net/, and then it's a squiggly mark, Watcher. And for all those who can't keep up with that, I'm going to have this link on the website, on the information page. Also, other important articles you can follow along in the program that will all the topics that we'll be discussing here today. On the Watcher website, you'll find a wealth of interesting articles and connection. But David has also written for other online magazines, and one of these articles is what we'll begin to discuss here today. We're going to focus on one of David's most recent discoveries on the geoglyphs of Tiahuanaco. This is near Lake Titicaca in Bolivia, South America. And the possibility that this vast prehistoric network of earthworks was built by giants. And this is a very interesting subject, so stay with us as we go through some of the background and set the context for this story. So with that, let's say welcome to the program to David Flynn. Hi, David. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Henrik. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Looking forward to this very much. And as I mentioned there, we are definitely going to dive into this most recent discovery of yours. And we're going to skip a little bit of the standard background introductions, so to speak, today, simply because I want to discuss as much as I can of the of your research. It's brilliant, and there's so many connections and threads to all of this. So we'll definitely keep busy here for the two segments that we'll be doing. So basically, to kind of lead us into the entire subject here, if you will, David, tell us a little bit about how you made this recent discovery, how you kind of come across some of the material, and how you discovered these very kind of unnatural patterns, if you will, near the Lake Titicaca.
I was finishing up the last draft of my book, which is coming out soon. I'm thinking July 1st, and this book deals with the Temple of Jerusalem and Newton's work on it and its centrality in, at least when it comes to the Jewish sages' writings on it. And it's very fairly obscure works that Newton has that deal with this temple and its idea of not only a religious centrality, but actually time-centered centrality, which is very esoteric and kind of astounding. I was able to actually find that there were correlations in history between where a location of a actual civilization center was and its distance from this temple of Jerusalem and a correlation with time. And this is what the book is about. It's called Temple at the Center of Time, And when I was looking at South America, because I'd known that there were megalithic sites there, especially Tiwanaku, Ollantaytambo, Sacsayhuaman, these places in Peru and also in Bolivia, I thought there would probably there'd be a correlation there also. And so I took Google Earth, which is an amazing sort of program. And I think if Newton were alive today, he would have been completely blown away by the actual facilities we have now with the World Wide Web and computer programs that you can have for free or with a song that would have cost a king's ransom to do in his day. Like programs like for working through the Bible, like concordances and lists of languages that you can find now at your fingertips. Those things, a scholar had to understand perfect Latin, they had to understand full Greek, full Hebrew to actually go through the Bible. Now it's easy to do. You can just go into the online and find these things out.
Yeah.
So on Google, I found that they had actually upped the resolution of the maps that they have. And it was actually fairly recently. It was only in April of this year.
Mm-hmm.
They increased the pixel resolution of the maps, especially around Lake Titicaca. And I'd zoomed in specifically over the megalithic site Tiwanaku, and there happened to be some strange patterns that radiated outward from it. And the closer I looked, the more they stood out, the more they became significant and anomalous, because as you would move across the topography, you would actually see these things connected, a contiguous sort of carpet that laid out not only around Tiwanaku, but from the shores of Lake Titicaca itself, into Peru and into Bolivia and into the Altiplano that's on top of the Andes, almost 6,000 square miles of area completely saturated with these things. They were incredibly large. Also, you can actually find excised bedrock in the size of these hills and foothills and mountains around the Andes in this area that look like they've actually had chunks of rock taken out, many, many tons of this rock taken out.
Hmm.
And they're actually measurable with the application on Google. You can find excisions that are about maybe 30 to 60 feet wide that go on for several miles. And this is in rock and other detritus of the area. These things are completely anomalous in addition, because the area is 13,000 feet above sea level. In fact, if tourists come to the area to check things out in La Paz, Bolivia, where they have the Museum of Bolivia, they actually hand out supplemental oxygen for the guests so that they don't get altitude sickness
and
stay overnight.
Right.
So if you look at this extensive work, you realize that it would have taken an incredible amount of effort on a human scale, many, many thousands of people over perhaps hundreds of years to do it. But if you start looking at the history of the area and what the Spanish chroniclers said about the Inca that inhabited the area and what the Inca had to say about Tiwanaku itself and even these anomalous lines and geoglyphs that extend beyond geoglyphs too. I mean, there's ones that you can find in bedrock that have been covered over with sediment that was laid down during the Pleistocene. So that means that they were actually laid down before the Pleistocene, which goes back 13,000 years, because the geology of the areas is pretty concise.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then is that you have to pay attention to what the earliest people that we know of, that we actually have a record of, that comes back from the Spanish chroniclers, what they had to say about the area. And basically they just say that the area had been inhabited from a time before the earth was destroyed, at least two times. And they even talk about how one of the destructions was caused by a small moonlet that the earth had, and it had two at this early point. They had been decaying in their orbit. This is before the moon that we know, Luna, had been, as they say, captured
Right.
This sort of thing is so astounding and strange that you realize that most chroniclers and most historians are going to just put it off as just plain myth. But Arthur Poznanski, maybe the century before this one, spent several decades looking at the area and actually doing tests of the geology there and the geography and you know, talking to the locals.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that when he was doing some excavations over of Tiwanaku, he found that the detritus that was laid over that area was indeed laid down by the end of Pleistocene era, and that there was actually layers, incumbent layers of this detritus, that held seashells and marine fossils, and underneath that, lignite of ash and charcoal, and evidence of a great immolation or conflagration of the area. Something so horrific that it seared the ground. But this actually fits into what the Spanish chroniclers picked up from some of the Inca priests of the area. That the area had been completely destroyed, not just by water, but also by fire. And that the great god Viracocha had created all humanity from that point, and from Lake Titicaca itself. And that the actual city of Tiwanaku was incredibly advanced, akin to what Plato had written about Atlantis, and that it had been built in only one night. And that when it was built, it was actually built to somehow commemorate the race that was soon to be destroyed by this moon that was coming into... it had reached its Roche limit, and it was fragmenting, and it was coming into a burn up in the atmosphere. What's really interesting is that one of the translations of Tiwanaku itself is City of the Moon. And the huge stone ashlar that sits at the temple there has many of these embossed reliefs on its surface, and Poznanski thinks was a calendar. Actually tells the same tale of this moon crashing into the earth and the capture of the great moon we have now, and that that there was a great flood, and that there must have been a period of incredible uplift of the Andean range at the time this thing was built, because what Arthur Poznanski also discovered was that Lake Titicaca was not just an inlet lake. It's one of the highest lakes in the world. It's certainly the highest navigable lake in the world. But it has seahorses in it. The fish that actually don't survive in fresh water at all. They somehow adapted to this fresh water environment.
Interesting.
And what he thought was that the area had actually been at one time at sea level, and that Lake Titicaca was just an inlet. But what's also interesting about that is that just a few meters away is a place called Pumapunco, where there are huge andesite blocks that are laid out in the pattern of a wharf, and that they were once for docking ships. Now they're covered with almost 6 feet of sediment. So Poznanski put all this together and wrote his books on these on this area, and was pretty much merely dismissed in the academic circles. But now you look with satellite maps at the area, and you find that not only what he was talking about is verifiable, because you can see the geology of the area, you find these anomalous geoglyphs that are so extensive and so architecturally almost impossible to achieve when you think of the altitude that the place is at now,
yeah.
And it has been since the Pleistocene era, 15,000 years ago. And if you combine that with what Poznanski was saying, and the chronicles of the area from the Inca and the pre-Inca, you realize that you're seeing something that is extraordinary, and its significance is far beyond what most people right now, I think, can actually piece together. because there's so little information on this phenomena.
Hmm. And you know, if we were to talk a little bit about some of the, you know, definitely I recommend, you know, people to check out the article where you can find the images of what David is talking about here, Google screen captures basically. But also what you can do is actually that you go on Google Earth and you actually search for Tiwanaku, you can even link up from a place mark, and I can have this up on the website too. This is a GMC file, and you can just click on this, and this will take you directly to this location that David is talking about. So you actually can fly around the area and take a look for yourself there, and that's a really incredible part about this. But I mean, what we see there is basically, as you mentioned, there's like a myriad of very intricate lines. Some look like perfect perfect squares. Some are rectangles. We even find circles. Do you know at this point how big, you know, some of these lines are? I mean, what when we're looking upon this here, are we talking about several, you know, 100 meters, or just a few meters each? Do we know, David?
Yeah, there. You can actually measure them with some of the applications on Google Earth. In the images that I captured and subsequently put in an article that was on Reuters News Update, and also in UFO Magazine, I think in the June-July issue that came out, you can actually see a superimposed 747, which I put in this, which is about 250 feet long. And it's superimposed for scale. You can find whole hillsides that have had rock removed in these strange sort of labyrinth-like patterns.
Mm-hmm.
They don't run horizontally along the sides of these mountains. In many cases, they run vertically, perpendicularly. Sometimes there's these weird sort of rectilinear cells that are on the mountainsides. And they're all packed together. But when you see, you can actually see the superimposed 747, you can see that it can actually fit into some of these rectilinear shapes. And sometimes it'll take a couple 747s to actually fit into these shapes.
Hmm.
So we're talking about, you know, millions of tons of rock that has been removed, and an extensiveness that would require architecture and surveying and deliberation of many centuries. But if you're thinking about a human agency actually having created it, that would make sense. When Pizarro came into the area with his conquistadors, and actually was able to have some of the priests chronicle what the Incas said about Leaf Tiwanaku, the legends all stated that the area had been produced for a legacy of a race that was soon to be destroyed, and that it had been created incredibly quickly. And by means that were not conventional at all. So these things are what the chroniclers say, and they also say other astounding things, like there were several different races of people, and the farther back you go, the races of people become races of something else, humanoid, but not exactly human.
Yeah.
And that's what Poznanski actually realized, too, when he was excavating Tiwanaku. He uncovered skeletons that were incredibly anomalous. Skulls that had cranial capacities up to 3 times larger than modern men.
That is incredible.
Fossilized.
Huh, wow.
And they still actually exist in the museum in La Paz.
Yeah.
So, and I think David Hatcher Childress, who's also chronicled much about Tiwanaku and other megalithic sites on the Earth, had actually captured some images of these anomalous skulls. He actually called them the cone heads of Bolivia.
Right.
But that's what they look like. They have these incredible craniums,
yeah,
that come to points, and the cranial mass is sometimes up to 3 sizes of modern men. You can't create that sort of thing with binding of the skull, which is really common in the Americas, the ancient Indians.
Mm.
And then sometimes in Asia. But the only way this can happen is if there's a genetic sort of predisposition to large cranial mass.
Right. And do we know how old these are, these skulls? Have they done any testing on them? Do you know?
Znansky found these skeletons in the Pleistocene alluvials that were covering Tiwanaku. So they were fossilized, and they were at least as old as the tribes had been pulled over the area by water, which he called marine alluvials,
mm-hmm.
signifying that he thought that they had been brought over by the ocean, which is an incredible statement, knowing that the Andean Range is, at that area, 13,000 feet high.
Yeah. I mean,
well, he thought they were at least predating... they were at least 13,000 years old, but probably in the order of around 30,000.
Wow, really? I mean, I've actually heard stories about, or theories, I guess I should say that Lake Titicaca actually was at some point at a much lower altitude from sea level, and that the entire Altiplano actually is an area that has been raised up because of earth changes that has been going on, you know, basically on the entire globe. I mean, there's two ways to look at this. One is, of course, that the object that you mentioned before, this moon that was passing by or even colliding and crashing into Earth, was creating an incredible tidal wave, basically, that brought a lot of seawater and consequently, you know, covered up this entire area. What do you think? Do you have a specific theory about this, what actually happened here?
Yeah, Emmanuel Vygotsky covers the Andean Range really extensively in his book, Worlds in Collision. And he talks about Tiwanaku specifically. He says the same thing that Poznanski was, that he thinks that there were several series of cataclysms that were worldwide, and that they did include celestial bodies, very massive ones, moving close to the Earth. The effects of a small moon that's actually recorded in the great sun calendar that's there at the great temple in Tiwanaku actually says the same thing. But what Vygotsky was saying was that when these moons actually move so close into the atmosphere of the Earth, not only did they fragment, they also, you know, like you were saying, pull huge tidal bulges around the near the equator.
Yeah.
As soon as they fragmented, then these large floods that would have moved across the surface of the land retreated towards the poles, carrying all the Pleistocene flora and fauna with it.
Yeah.
And indeed, when you actually look at what's deposited in Alaska and in Siberia and other places in northern Canada, you find what's sometimes termed muck, a mixture of coniferous trees, deciduous trees, flora and fauna from the temperate and tropical zones, as well as the Arctic, all combined into one mass. You know, hippo, crocodile, dire wolf, saber-toothed tiger, mastodon, all these animals crunched into one layer. And even Charles Darwin was able to find evidence of this in the glaciers of the Andes when he was visiting Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that Vygotsky was noticing was that there seemed to be several series of these cataclysms, and that the Andes had indeed actually been raised for several thousand feet every time these cataclysms came to the Earth. And also that he thought that Tiwanaku and Lake Titicaca were at sea level at one time.
Right.
And that it was it was actually an inlet to an actual bustling port city at one time.
That is fascinating. And, you know, one thing I'd like to ask you a little bit about is if you think that there is basically a message in the carvings, if you will, these etchings that are in the landscape, because in your article that you wrote for officialdisclosure.org or Survival Mall, that there is a little bit of hint that this is pointing towards an alien or artificial or almost some, you know, otherworldly type of communication that is going on here. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, the shapes that you see are, according to what some of the Pizarro's chroniclers had recorded, the shapes that you see are actually supposed to cause a consciousness change in men, in the actual observer. You can see that if you look closely at some of the art history that's on the Tiwanaku statues, they are almost exactly the same. And the literature around this art is that it's supposed to change the consciousness of men, and actually to raise it. And there's a legend that Viracocha, the god that, the creator god of the Inca and the pre-Inca, had actually had a temple in the center of Lake Titicaca, like submerged, and that there was a disc made out of gold that the Inca priests valued higher than anything they actually owned, because it was actually designed to align with the center of the galaxy at a certain point during a cyclical point of the precession of the equinox of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And this opens up a couple concepts that are somewhat difficult for some people to understand, because you have to know what the precession of the equinox is and what its duration is. And a cycle is roughly 26,000 years. And basically, all this is our orientation in space as we go around the sun. We're slightly at an angle so that we have our seasons as we, you know, hurtle around the sun.
Right.
But that angle, of course, we spin like a top very, very slowly. So where our pole, our celestial pole is, say, for north, is actually changing continuously, tracing this large circle in the northern hemisphere, celestial hemisphere. But the Inca understood exactly how long this took. It's actually 25,920 years.
Right, the great year, and I know that many of our listeners are familiar with the precession of the equinox, and if they aren't, they definitely can read up on it. But we should assume at this point, David, that everyone listening are familiar with the precession of the equinox.
Yes, the Inca understood that the precession had a cyclical nature, and that there were actually quaternary points in it where they looked forward to. But they would anticipate cataclysm on Earth.
Yeah.
And it was at these points too that they didn't really recognize them as just danger points, because what would happen was also a rebirth, a resurgence of civilization after cataclysm. They actually looked at it as a cleansing, in a way. So this disc was actually designed to align with the center of the galaxy and pull in this light. They actually called it, metaphorically, I suppose, light, but it was supposed to represent some sort of high knowledge that came from on high that was actually purveyed by Viracocha himself.
Hmm.
And Viracocha actually fits a lot of the cosmological creation myths that are found in the Middle East.
Really?
The Sumerian ones, the Babylonian, the Egyptian, the idea that the earliest god was somehow born from the celestial sea, and he's characterized by coming from the foam of the sea. Viracocha actually means the foam of the sea.
Hmm.
And what the foam of the sea then was actually is the Milky Way itself, the galaxy, as it would actually be during these solstices and equinoxes, at this point that they say this golden disc would be aligned and actually with the center of the galaxy and pull in this information.
Hmm.
But what actually happened was that the galaxy, the Milky Way, would align itself on the horizon of the Earth right before sunrise, and that the sun would itself rise in the center of the galaxy. And knowing that that actually occurs, and then looking at the history of the Spanish chroniclers of the area of the Inca, you find that they had a extraordinary knowledge that we're only coming up to speed with now. But this idea that the center of the galaxy somehow aligns at these quarter points of the precession of the equinox, that we are approaching one right now, you combine that with the information that's in the Mayan calendar, which points to 2012 actually as being that point where we are aligned to the center of the galaxy.
Right.
And that there's an end point and then again a beginning or a rebirth. These fit together even though they're separated by thousands of miles and many thousands of years.
Mm.
There's the pre-Inca. I mean, there was chronicles of pre-Inca existing far beyond written history. And the farther back you go, the more sophisticated they seem to be.
Hmm.
And these ideas are also connected, of course, to the Pseudepigrapha and the Apocrypha of the Western canon, the Bible itself,
right.
Writings of the Hebrew sages. These all fit exactly what the Mayan and the Inca and the Aztec and the Toltec and all these groups were talking about. But not only that, you can go and open up your regular old James Bible to Genesis 6 and find information that connects to the giants, the story of their creation of large cities, this idea that they actually had a civilization and they were in rule of it before they were destroyed. You can find that in the Old Testament, especially Genesis 6, where it's actually talking about the giants that were in the earth and that they had actually been the product of a breeding program by some extraterrestrial force,
yeah,
which, as a Christian, I believe was angelic, but rebel angelic. They created the Nephilim, and Nephilim in Hebrew just means the fallen one. From that point, you can launch into all the other creation myths around the globe, about as far back as you can actually access them.
Right.
And they all have that salient point.
You know, so
there was a destructive epic,
yeah.
But there is going to be another one that's coming.
Hmm. So, David, what I want to ask you right there is that, do you think that this rebel force, obviously then led by Lucifer, if you will, that they came down to Earth and basically at that point set up the entire, you know, megalithic system of you know, incredible monuments that we can see from all over the world, because basically wherever we, you know, focus a little bit more on, we can see that, you know, we can find them in South America, in North America, we can find them in throughout Europe, in Asia, you know, certainly in Africa as well, and, you know, Middle East, Baalbek, all of these incredible sites that have these, you know, as you pointed out in many of your lectures, these incredible, you know, trilithons that they weigh, you know, immense, you know, immense stone structures basically that they put together. Do you think that this is have come from the same group of beings then that came from the outside?
Now, this is one of the most fascinating points, I think, that you could have touched on, and that's the commonality of this origin of civilization. As it comes from the civilization myths of most the greatest antiquity that we actually have resources of, I guess it's focusing on the idea of the name of these creatures to begin with.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest examples of an explanation of the descent of these things is the apocryphal book of, or the pseudepigraphic work of Enoch, which I guess is the Book of Enoch.
Yeah.
And Enoch talks about what's translated into English as the Watchers, them coming down and actually breeding with the daughters of Adam. And the actual writing for the Watcher is a word that would be pronounced more like ear or eerie in the Hebrew.
Really?
And the Semitic word is used all the time for these beings here. But if you look in the Old Testament, you can find that word written Ayin Resh in the Hebrew letters is also used in exact the same form as the word for city here.
Hmm.
So the first time you actually read of where Enoch built the city, or not Enoch, but Cain, the first man who ever built the city, who is Cain, it talks about the city being called an ear. If you read in the Book of Enoch about the Watchers, they're called ear.
Hmm.
Ear is actually the Greek root for Aries,
the god
of Mars, or even the place of Mars itself.
Hmm.
It's an absolute absolute connection when it comes to the etymology. And historically, if you look back far enough, you'll find that there's a connection between the worship of Mars and this idea of learning how to build and cause civilization to come into being, and this idea also of making war with other groups, and Mars itself as a planet.
Yeah.
And jumping all the way to the future again, to the idea of when the end cataclysm comes, when this next cataclysm that eschatology looks forward to, of biblical prophecy, and many New Age groups, and all these ancient civilizations that have records looking, you know, back into incredible antiquity, they always have a focus toward the future and the next cataclysm that's coming.
Yeah.
They talk about these watchers coming back also.
Hmm.
And that's our focus now, amazingly, is again on Mars. And the UFO phenomena seems to be focused on the geometry that is around this whole manifestation of the megaliths, what we find on Mars, what we've actually found on Cydonia Mars, which my first book was about. That connection goes back and forth so many times that it's actually kind of overwhelming.
It is.
Put it all together and to set it out so that someone actually can see that the repetitions of the idea that Mars brought civilization into being on this Earth, and that somehow it will be resurrected again.
Yeah.
That we're not actually now at the peak of civilization. The ancients actually foretold to a golden age or resurgence of a golden age through the agency of these beings that came once, were wiped off the planet, and are supposed to come back.
Hmm. You know, and David, when you were speaking about these rebel angels, watchers, or even the messengers, as you called them in one of your talks, you said that they can't avoid doing the symbolic things that they do anymore, that we can avoid following the law of gravity. And I think that's a really nice way to put it, because as you just mentioned, that the connections between all of these, you know, symbolic communications, if you will, if we look at the Mars-Earth connection, or if we look at some of the place names and so forth, it's just incredible. But I think that you've used a word for that, and I think you refer to it as theurgy. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit, and what it means, and why, you know, it is important to signify something like a place in time, and even the naming of the thing, if you will.
Yeah, the idea that these beings are so stuck when it comes to what it is they do, the repetition patterns that they actually do things in, is because their nature, what they were designed to do is just communicate. They're emissaries. They communicate from a higher level to a lower level. And not only that, they communicate in between themselves. And their very name just means messenger. Angelos in Greek, and Malachim, I guess, in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Very same idea. That name just means messenger. That's their reason for being. And when they actually manifest through their activities now, it's a completely a message. It's a complete thought, but it goes beyond what most humans think of as a communication, because they're not just left to our frame of reference. They have an extent that comes outside our temporal existence.
Right.
Which means that they can think forward into and actually interact with one moment in time, at one event in time. They will still have events that connect to that they've foreseen many years ahead. And it also stands to reason that if it's at a higher level than human intellect, whenever an angel would interact on this plane of our existence, that there would be pure thought, which is mathematical and geometrical.
Yeah.
So that you can actually anticipate that sort of communication being conveyed whenever you see a UFO sighting, even something that seems mundane.
Right.
And especially something that is extraordinary, like, say, a recovery or of the third or fourth, you know, other encounters where you have mass sightings or UFO flaps.
Right.
You have to pay particular attention to when it happens, where it happens, the coordinates of where it happens, the number of objects. I mean, all these things are important because it's pure communication, and it's at a level that's far higher than you would anticipate from our perspective.
And David, would you say that it isn't until it also reaches the mainstream that this kind of communication becomes important? But because in many cases it seems to be that many, like, let's say we look at a UFO sighting, for instance, then that can be something, you know, very hidden away, so to speak, and the mass media never touches upon it. But then once in a while you get these kind of large events, like, let's say, the Phoenix Light, or if, I don't know if you've heard about it yet, David, but there's this very recent one just now that occurred, interestingly enough, now at the summer solstice, just yesterday, or you know, these cops were chasing a UFO over Cardiff in Wales in the UK, and allegedly they were almost colliding with a UFO in a shopper, and this has become rather big in the media now. But anyway, my question here, I guess, is that is it only when this become large, like in the mainstream, that is, it is of this importance, or does it also apply to when it's not so such a big event, so to speak?
Yeah, it also applies when it's not such a big event, and this falls back into the temporal sort of control that these messengers have.
Yeah.
Because they realize that sometimes what they're doing is just a catalyst for a greater event in the future. But do they know actually that what they've actually, manifested in the ground, well, let's just, for sake of argument, say that there is such thing as a UFO-created crop circle.
Right.
And that crop circle is actually a pure thought and pure information that, although we may not understand it in the weeks that we are investigating it after it's actually occurred, somebody a year later or two years later will actually decode it. Or there will be an event that correlates to it that will have occurred, and the understanding will suddenly become widespread. However, there's other things that are happening too. Some of these images that you see in crop circles actually do stimulate the human mind in ways that we aren't quite up to speed with.
Hmm.
In the same way that I was saying that the Tiahuanaco geoglyphs also supposedly were supposed to heighten men's awareness at a specific time. They're calibrated to work at a point in time, just like if you set a clock. And that's what I mean then by theurgy, because they basically the word just means to bend or to manipulate almost architecturally the will of God. And in the pagan religions and in the occult, it's not so much the will of God, but spiritual forces outside of that, out of the God of God.
Right.
And this, in the Judeo-Christian framework, would be an angelic force. And
right.
We know there are lines on two sides, for and against the will of God. You know that there is actually then some conflict that's going on.
Yeah.
And that this manifestation that they place here on Earth addresses that conflict.
Hmm.
And so to get actually a reading on what the heck's going on with it, there has to be some sort of handbook. For me, it's the Old Testament, it's the New Testament.
Right.
And I try to parse these things out in their original languages. And you find answers every time. I can think back to first events that at least we know in America is the most popular. The idea that modern ufology was actually created by this event, and that's the Roswell event in 1947.
Indeed.
Now, this is a theurgic event, and it's really easy to explain how theurgic it is, because you can take only three data points from it. That is, where it occurred on latitude, where it occurred on longitude, and what year it occurred. And every one of those numbers happens to be a function of not only the geometry on Cydonia, Mars, but also focuses on the year 2012.
Hmm.
It hits also the numbers that we know as universal constants, what SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has been looking for decades. These universal constants are exactly what we would assume an intelligence greater than ours, or at least level to ours, would be broadcasting.
Yeah.
Because they don't depend on any language to decipher. Mathematics is universal.
Hmm.
So what you see with the Roswell crash is that it occurred at roughly 33 degrees in latitude. What's interesting about that is if you could take the number pi, which mathematicians think is transcendental, which means they think it goes on forever into decimal places, but it's basically 3.1415926. You can plug that into 33. You multiply pi times 33,
yeah,
and you get the longitude, which is 103.67. You can draw a little crosshairs, and you can find that's exactly where at least one of these disks that was reported to have crashed in 1947 actually was recovered.
Hmm.
And then in addition to that, if you take 103.67, which is the longitude, say, of the crash site,
yeah,
and you multiply that times 19.47, you end up in the date 2018. If you take 103.67 and convert it into what you have, minutes and seconds, in degrees, minutes and seconds, when it comes to longitude and latitude, and not just a decimal system,
mm-hmm,
it comes out to 103.40, and that puts you into 2013 when you multiply it times 19.47.
Mm.
19.47 is just a fractal of the year that this occurred. But at the same time, you realize that 33 is a symbol of a third of something.
Yeah.
And then decimal, 100%, 33 would represent a third of it. If you're looking at, say, a sphere that's divided into three parts, like the Earth, you realize that the three-dimensional object that would do that would be a tetrahedron.
Hmm.
If you're looking down from a pole and you actually have had a tetrahedron with one of its vertices touching the pole, you'll see it separating the Earth in three perfect segments.
Yeah.
If you look at so that you're looking at the axis obliquely, so the axis is straight up and down, you can see that this tetrahedron that's superimposed inside the sphere, which, by the way, they're two polar opposites of the platonic solids. You have the sphere, which is the highest form, and the tetrahedron, which is the lowest form. You can't have a shape that has less sides.
Right.
So anyway, the tetrahedron and the sphere superimposed like this. In a system like we have on the Earth, where zero is the equator and 90 degrees is where the poles are at, the other vertices of this tetrahedron will touch at 19.47 degrees on the latitude,
right,
or south, depending on where you put the vertices in the south or the north pole. This is something that Richard Hoagland, in his book Monuments of Mars, covered extensively because he kept finding this signature in the geometry of the Cydonia monuments itself, and even the location of it on Mars. And then this thing turns up in an event far earlier than anything we've discovered. The Viking, missions to Mars occurred in 76. But in 1947, we have all the components of tetrahedral geometry encoded in this event. And you can take it another step, because we're not just looking at say the mathematics and the geometry of this whole thing. This fits into history, and this fits into theology that is already intact, that's already available to us.
Yeah.
Because those numbers show up again and again in the biblical text, in the Apocrypha, and outside the Western canon also.
Mm.
They also show up in Asian works. You find it in the Popol Vuh, you find it in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, Bhagavad Gita. Yeah,
and you find these listed over and over again. They're universal.
Yeah.
And you have to stand back and look at it. What is it trying to tell us?
Indeed.
It all fits back into this idea of the cyclical nature of cataclysm, and that there's some force that's getting us ready for that time, which is incredibly near. So that's what theurgy fits into, because when men actually are able to, and this is an interesting thought, that the idea that men as theurgists somehow can cause these higher powers, angelic forces, if you will, to manifest themselves on the earth, or to intervene, or to actually maybe work with men on the earth, then men will actually parse out what it is that these previous interventions, the previous manifestations contain, the information that they contain, and then again manifest that same information in structures that they built on the earth and in structures that they built at certain times, structures that they built at certain locations. Just like I may have explaining, angelic messages actually come forth
there, and that is, I mean, that's incredibly fascinating. And what you know, to kind of, you know, summarize here a little bit on the first segment as we begin to close off here, and then begin in the second one, we can say that with the background of what we talked about at the site that you discovered in Bolivia, Tiahuanaco, this is a one place then in you know, at the across the globe that we can potentially find evidence for that some beings, so to speak, have been involved in building these structures for potentially ritualistic purposes. And what you also have been mentioning a little bit is that if we look at year, we can look at dates, we can look at places in regards to latitude, longitude, we can look at place names. These all kind of incorporate into one system that is involved in a communication. And I guess a last question before we run things off here, David, would be, is this a communication to educate us in a fashion in order to, you know, help us to get through the upcoming cataclysms, or is this an indoctrination that is going on? Do you have a take on that?
It depends on your moral alignment, I guess, because from my perspective, it only strengthens my belief system, which is a Christian paradigm.
Mm.
Because I see this fits into prophecy. I actually fit, you know, I see how this all fits into the whole scheme that has been written going back 1500 or up to 3,000 years ago. That were, you know, predictions of this cyclical system that fits right into the idea that you find in Revelation, that you find in the major prophets talking about the second advent of the Messiah.
Hmm.
On the other hand, this the force at the same time is also indoctrinating, like you say, others, because if there is an absolute, if there is a moral absolute, there's actually a belief that there is evil and there is good, and that there are forces on either side of this, then by all means, because there is a war going on, because there's a contest going on, both of these forces are going to be conveying their side of things in these theurgic manifestations, and these basically supernatural manifestations, in the UFO phenomena, the crop circle phenomena, and I think also what we're seeing on the Andean plateau near Tiahuanaco, that was not perceivable until our age.
Right.
Until the Quick Bird satellite took those photographs at that high resolution, and they were put on the web in April of 2007, we would never have known they were there because they're too extensive. The place is too remote. In our perspective from the ground, you can't even see that there's something there.
Right.
But from the perspective of space, it's absolutely mind-boggling how huge it is and how complex it is.
Hmm.
And so that by itself is saying something about the timing of the event and why it was put there. It may be a big component of it. It may just be something that's aside, but at the same time, it still fits into the theurgic sort of theory. So I think it can be both. I think it can actually be helping the faithful to grow in their faith, to push them forward in their belief. It can also be just misleading people. It can also be quite damaging when it comes to the Christian belief system and also the world system as it is right now.
Hmm.
And that's an incredibly hot topic nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it will be discussed when I go down to Roswell here in near the 4th of July for the D4 conference.
Oh, okay.
You're
going back there to do another lecture?
Yeah. And it's going to be talking specifically about the Roswell message, what it means, and what really is going to happen as what the message that's actually in the ground in Roswell, what's really going to happen in 2012? What does it mean?
Right.
Why did other people who had some sort of inkling of this, even Terence McKenna, who looked at this through the I Ching,
right,
the mathematical system, was able to say, time itself will stop. How could he say such a thing?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm going to address.
Oh, fascinating. And David, for people who are interested in attending that lecture, that conference, do you know a website that people can take a look at to get tickets and so forth?
Yeah, I think it's... I'd have to Google it. I Googled it myself. It's a CE4 2008 Roswell Alien Conference, Roswell UFO Conference, I guess. There's also a number of sites from the promoter, Joseph Jordan, and it isn't too hard to find.
Okay.
The city of Roswell is promoting it pretty heavily, too, so there's a lot of information that's on the search engine.
Perfect.
Sorry, I don't have the exact website, though.
No problem. I'll do like this. I'll do a little search for it, and once I find it, I have it up on our information page that is related to this program, so people can find that easily when they tune in here. But I've obviously tons of questions, and we have so much more to talk about. I definitely want to get into a little bit more about this 2012 thing and the overall communication, what you think is going to happen here in our next segment. I also want to ask you more about, you know, the doomsday clock, etc. If this is considered to be, so to speak, forbidden knowledge, what the potential connection is with the so-called illuminated fraternities, and there's so much more to talk about here. But before we round things off here, David, for this segment, I want to leave the last few minutes here so you can talk a little bit about your next book, of course, but also the books that you have out there already, and how people can get copies of those who want to dive further into your work.
Gee, thank you. That's a good idea. My first book is out of print now, but I may have it reprinted. What is coming out, though, in July 1st, and you can find it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, is called Temple at the Center of Time.
Mm.
And this focuses on the phenomena of the Jerusalem Temple and its idea of religious and actually physical centrality on this earth. Why it was put there and why it is so revered as a location where, according to the Jewish sages, time itself starts from this point on the earth. And in fact, they say that all creation itself started from that one point on the earth where the temple used to stand. And which seems, it doesn't make much sense, unless you actually look at Isaac Newton, one of the founders of the idea of science itself, really believed this, and that the writings that he has that are very obscure and hardly known except for a great program that's actually come up in Cambridge called the Newton Project. You can access some of these obscure writings that he has about the temple, and some maybe not so obscure, but just not widely known. Like observations on the prophecies of Daniel and St. John and chronology of ancient kingdoms. These works actually focus on the Temple of Jerusalem, and they focus on this idea that somehow temple, architecturally and location-wise, point out specific prophecies in the future and when they're going to actually occur, and in some way fits into time itself. The idea that the temple is the key to all prophecy, and to time, and location, and space. It's almost as if Newton thought it was a holistic key to all of his physical laws. And the book addresses this idea, and I discovered that there were some things that if Newton was alive today, he could have proved his theory that the temple was the center of time, at the center of location, because historically, it is actually located so that if you measure its distance from, say, Babylon to Jerusalem, and Babylon actually had brought all these Jews into exile there, when Babylon fell in 539 BC, and you measure the distance between it and Jerusalem, it is 539 statute miles. This goes on and on between every one of the actual cities of significant countries that had anything to do with Israel's history, and especially the temple,
mm-hmm.
and their distances from it. And that's what the book is about, and that is coming out in the first part of July. And apart from that, I've pretty much done nothing else because it was a daunting sort of task going through some of the work that Newton has. Some of it, of course, hasn't been translated into English, so you had to kind of brush up on Latin and work pretty hard to figure out what was being completely said. But that's what's been happening.
Oh, I can imagine. Oh, it sounds very interesting indeed, and I definitely have a few questions about that later on as well. That's very interesting. And I guess is your website the primary location to go to get a copy of the book once it's out?
Going to Amazon, the bookstore there.
Yeah.
It's also at tower.com, Christian Book Source, Barnes and Noble. So yeah, the major books. Bookstores. You can find it mostly online right now in pre-orders.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go down to my local Hastings and ask them to stock it.
Right.
Bring my friends to say, "Here's my book." Go on the computer to find it.
That's a good idea. I will do like this. I'll have a link up, of course, to David's website and also to Amazon, so people who are interested and can find. This easy on how to get a copy. But with this, stay with us. There's so much more to talk about here, but we're going to take a short break at this point here. So if you will, David, stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this break.